Thank you so much. Hi, my name is Arielle. I am a grateful recovering alcoholic, and it's really an honor to be here. I don't think my story is particularly unique. I think I was born an alcoholic. I'll explain that a little later, but I think that the moment I started drinking, there was a genetic predisposition that would have driven me to drink in an amazing way. but my home life growing up really added to the need to drink. I grew up in I've always felt it was kind of a schizophrenic home. So I was very supported in music. I played the cello for many years and was a gifted cellist. I had my student license to fly an airplane before I had my license to drive. I had immense support in school and had many, many, many extracurricular activities. And my dad beat me and sexually molested me until the day I left home. And my mother knew about it. So, you know, there was this sort of back and forth kind of thing. And the thing I learned at home was to always be on my toes. You never knew what dad was bringing home, what kind of mood he was bringing home. And that was what ruled the family. That's what drove the family. And the problem wasn't so much, I mean, it was a terrible problem at home, but I knew how to manage that. But when I moved out and went to college, I took with me all these coping mechanisms that had no place to go because there was no more abuse, but my only knowledge or understanding of the world was from an abuse standpoint. So the first time I went out drinking with friends, I drank, it was Ripple wine. That's a terrible wine to get drunk on for your first time if you're going to do that. But it was Ripple wine, and I was at the University of Wyoming, and we went out to go tobogganing. And the only thing I remember was always missing the toboggan and going down on my parka coat. I was told later that I fought with my proctor about who was going to put me to bed and why. So I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. Now, I will tell you honestly that I liked that. I thought being a blackout drinker was totally cool. It meant that I could get out of the world and not be here anymore. I just thought that was wonderful. And I didn't really need you to inform me of what I did in the blackout, because quite honestly, that was the whole point of drinking to blackout. You don't want to know what's going on. I lost probably 4 or 5 years to drugs and alcohol. But alcohol was the one that was always really consistent. It was always there. I have been homeless. I have been a prostitute. I have woken in places where I have no clue where I am or who my bed partner was. I heard a person say once, the alcohol goes in, the pants come off, and it's like, oh, that one. There's not a lot of grace in being an alcoholic. There's not a lot of integrity in being an alcoholic. There's a great story in the Big Book that's my favorite story. It's about the jaywalker. And it talks about a person who's addicted to jaywalking. And, you know, you have a few problems with it. Maybe you get a ticket once or twice, you know, but it's not a big deal. And one day the jaywalker walks right in front of a car and breaks a leg. And recovers, you know, but it takes a little longer. And the next thing you know, that jaywalker's out there doing it again, and this time breaks his back. So then the jaywalker heals up from breaking his back. And 3 days later, he's back doing it again and eventually dies getting hit by a car jaywalking. And everybody's going, why is that guy still jaywalking? And my whole thing is, I totally get why he's still jaywalking, because that's what you have to do. It is not like this is an option. It, you know, I had to drink. Now, once I had done my little homeless prostitute gig, I didn't like that very much. It was not the toughest work you'll ever do is being a prostitute. And when I got my feet somewhat back under me, I became what a lot of people would refer to as a functional alcoholic. I never lost a job due to drinking. As far as I know, I didn't lose any relationships, but who knows, I was drinking. It could have happened. My first attempt at sobriety came in 1984. I had gone to Overeaters Anonymous, and I couldn't, in 1983, and I couldn't keep my food clean while I was drinking. So I thought maybe it would be a good idea if I quit drinking. So I quit drinking. But I didn't quit drinking in AA. I just quit drinking. And then the following year, 1985, I quit smoking. And 6 months later, I was in a mental institution because all my tools were gone and none of my problems were gone. None of the trauma had left me. None of the post-traumatic stress disorder had left me. I was just one, in all honesty, very fucked up human being. And I had no idea what was happening. I did not understand why I was constantly falling apart. I just did not understand it. And I got a lot of help in that institution. And I was so confused because, okay, I'm not drinking, I'm not eating, I'm not smoking, and I'm in a nut farm. What's happening here? And it was a great gift. It was a great gift. It's what needed to happen. So I'd stayed what I would call accidentally sober for about 7 or 8 years. And then, you know, it's like, yeah, I got this. This is not that big a deal. And so yeah, I had a drink now and then, which escalated into my drinking is my drink of choice is vodka. And that's what I like to drink. I like to put it in the freezer. And it escalated very quickly to anywhere from a pint to a fifth of vodka a night. And it's very hard to stay functional on that, just so you know. And I paid another visit to another institution. My husband and I had gone to celebrate our seventh anniversary, I think sixth or seventh anniversary. We were driving up to Mendocino. And it was raining and I was driving very fast, which was my habit. And we almost ran into an oncoming truck, spun around, flipped over on the side, and the windshield wipers are still going and the radio is still on. And Jim is saying to me frantically, get out of the car, get out of the car, it might catch fire. And I thought, now that might work. If we catch on fire, that'll do it. But it didn't feel fair to leave him in the car because he wasn't volunteering to get killed, I was. And that brought about my second run to an institution and my second sobriety. I got a little more into AA the second time around, but not really. I didn't want to be an AA. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, quite honestly. I thought that was kind of a low-class thing to be. I liked being an overeater. I could do that, but didn't want to be an alcoholic. So one night, my husband and I were out to dinner. He had a glass of wine. I had a glass of wine. I didn't get struck drunk, so I must have this under control. That means I can drink as long as we're out to eat. Now, my husband was not a man who was frugal. He was downright pernicious. I mean, he did not like spending money. He did not. And getting him to go out every night of the week so I could drink did not go well. He just wasn't going to have that. So he started buying wine for me. And so I started drinking wine. And then of course, wine to, you know, the story goes on. So the last time I got terribly drunk at home. And again, blackout, don't remember what I said. He was willing to recount pretty much every word. He said to me, you know, you need to choose either the alcohol or me. And frankly, I don't give a shit which one you do. That scared me. That really scared me. So I went back to AA, but this time I did it with a level of commitment that I had not had before. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I got myself a sponsor. I worked the steps. I went into service. I took the program much more seriously. And what I know is this, if I want to be well, I have to work the steps and I have to let them work their spiritual alchemy through me. Step one, the first part of step one is not hard for me. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. No question, no question. We went up to my brother-in-law's 60th birthday and he was born 7 years to the day of my husband's birthday. And we were up in Ashland and everybody was raving about this wine. And I knew I wouldn't drink, But I said, I'd love to smell it. So of course, swirl the glass, smell it. My whole body felt like I had touched an electrical wire when I smelled that wine. It was like, oh, we're going to drink, aren't we? Oh boy. And I went through probably another 2 or 3 months of just terrible, terrible craving. This third recovery of mine did not go smoothly. It was really hard. It took me almost 9 months to get 30 days. I couldn't not drink. I didn't get drunk, but I couldn't not drink. I couldn't not drink. I just couldn't. It took me years to get past the craving, years. So powerless over alcohol is no problem. My life had become unmanageable. I've got perfect management over my life. Thank you very much. I can manage anything that comes my way. Now, that's so not true. I was in a very, very difficult place in terms of managing a teaching job and my husband and my daughter who was seriously mentally ill. And just, so this was in 2004 that I got sober, May 21st, 2004, for the third time. So I absolutely knew I was powerless over alcohol, but unmanageable life, no, I needed my sponsor to help me with that because I didn't think I had an unmanageable life. I could do it all, plus a little. Now, I will tell you, I've been in therapy most of my life, trying to understand my need to do everything for everybody perfectly. And I have a tremendous difficulty making and keeping relationships. I have to really, really work at it because I don't trust relationships. I'm very, very scared of them. I'm scared I'm going to get hurt. I'm scared I'm going to hurt somebody. I'm scared I'm not going to do it right. I'm scared I'm going to make a mistake and break the relationship. It terrifies me. It's so, so hard for me to do. So when it came to step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, I had a hard time with that one because it assumed that I had ever been sane. My view of myself was that I had come from some galaxy far, far away and been dropped off here and told never to come home again. We not only don't want you, we don't want you to be able to find your way back to us. And I couldn't ever imagine ever having been sane. And I couldn't imagine a higher power that would allow the things that happened to me to happen. So I came in kind of a bristling agnostic and was told, act as if there is something greater than you are. Well, that's actually not that hard. If you've ever been in the middle of a big thunderstorm or tornado or, you know, some big natural event, there is no question there's something greater than I am. So that it wasn't that I had a problem with that. It was the God thing that I had a hard time with. That just, I don't know about that. But okay, I am willing to believe that at some vague point in time, I may have been sane and that there is a restoration to that level. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Okay, here's that God shit again. So I knew a friend in AA who used a doorknob as the higher power because the doorknob could either open or close doors. And I thought, what a great idea. And what I did was I used my AA group as my higher power. Group of drunks is one way to say God. Good orderly direction is another. But that's what I used. I could turn my will and my life over to people I knew cared about me and hope that the day went well. Step four, you know, again, talking about what happened to me and all the damage it caused in my later life was really hard because, you know, I carried so much shame. And shame is a weird thing. It's not like guilt, guilt is a conscience thing saying, that's a line you want to really think about before you go across it. It's sort of a caution. Shame, I am bad. I haven't done a bad thing. I am inherently a bad person. And step four can look like an invitation into deep shame. So what I did is I told my life story. I wrote down my whole life in bullet form and read that to my first sponsor. And from that fourth step and fifth step came my eighth and ninth steps. I think, you know, one of the things that a trauma survivor can do is go into a place where I'm just going to do what has to be done. And I think I am severed of all connection to fear or whatever, because that's what I have to do. That's what we know how to do. And that's how I did my fifth step. But afterwards, I was just traumatized. And I was all, you know, all I wanted to do was leave. And my sponsor said, I think you should stay and have a cup of coffee. I'm like, no, I really need to go down. She said, no, I really think you need to sit still. And I wept and wept. And I was so embarrassed. And she told me that embarrassment is being in the presence of more love than I can bear to take in. And then I cried a bunch more. The fourth step is a real gift. It's a way to lay out and then set aside all the things that hurt us. And we are such wounded people. Step six and seven, I really love. Step six talks about, you know, I come to know my character defects. Do I have any defects of character? Oh my God, let me count the ways. And becoming willing, not doing it yet, becoming willing to let them go. Not necessarily doing it, but becoming willing to do it. So this is, you know, in AA, they say this sets apart the men from the boys or the girls from the women. This, to me, actually sets apart those who are willing to stay sober and those who are not. Because in this step, I get to look at all the things that have served me so well. My tenacity. My, I won't let go of this no matter what. My, I can do it. Fuck you very much. Don't help me. My, I don't need you. Don't bother me. My, I mean, all these things that have worked so well for me, not, but I feel like I'm so attached to them. And in step six, I get to make a list of those things. And in step seven, I humbly ask God to take those defects from me. And I will tell you that they're almost always the flip side of a really good attribute. A really good attribute. My ability to procrastinate is pretty impressive. But the flip side of that is being cautious in making sure I don't do too much. So that can turn into, well, fine, I won't do anything. You know, I do have a tendency to take on too many things. Friends will tell you that, you know, sometimes I volunteer for about four too many things and I'm always saying, oh, it's just for now. Oh, it's just this time. Oh, well, it's okay. It's not okay. I get overwhelmed and then I have to really struggle. So there is a wonderful aspect to saying yes to service. And there is an aspect to saying yes to too much service where I am completely overwhelmed and can't do anything. So it's almost always in that step seven, a flip side of a positive attribute. It's just kind of gone. It's like a campfire versus a forest fire. Step eight was really helpful to me. I will tell you that the first time I went through the steps, the first thing I wanted to do was make amends to my parents. Because more than anything, I wanted them to love me. And I apologized for the horrible child I'd been, for the horrible person I'd been, on and on and on. And I will tell you, I did not get the love that I wanted. I think they were actually very puzzled by by the whole thing. I think they were very baffled by the whole thing. And I wasn't doing steps 8 and 9 for the right reasons. I wasn't doing it to stay sober. I was doing it to get love. And the only reason to do steps 8 and 9 is to stay clean and sober. I don't ever want to drink again. And that's the truth. I really don't ever want to drink again. I don't. And I will do anything to keep that from happening. So that's my steps 8 and 9. And then step 10 is this daily inventory. And what I do is when I go to bed at night, I ask myself 3 questions. What could I have done better? What went well? And what am I grateful for? And right now my granddaughter's staying with me and we do this together. So we take turns. And it's really fun to do with a 12-year-old. Their view of the world is quite different than mine. Quite different than mine. Step 11 is probably one of my favorite steps. I am such a believer in prayer and meditation. It is, so my understanding of a higher power has changed vastly. I want to talk about that just a little bit. I don't really understand God as a remotely human or even gendered being. My understanding for my higher power, it is simply this huge source of energy, huge, and is coming off of this huge source are lines and webs for every single living creature anywhere in the universe. And we could either be traversing toward the source, away from the source, parallel to the source. We can even jump off one line in a suicide attempt. We will be caught by another line and still have decisions to make. And my spiritual fitness, I gauge my spiritual fitness by how deep into my line I am. Am I immersed? Am I neck deep? Am I knee deep? Am I ankle deep? Am I even aware that I'm on the line? That's my understanding of my higher power. And the God of my understanding does not reach in and say, you're going to get cancer, but you're not. And your child is going to die, but yours isn't. And your family's going to have a terrible car accident, but yours isn't. There's no intervening. We are here and mortal and on our own. But the God of my understanding is a permanent resource to me. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And step 12 is kind of what I'm doing tonight a little bit, carrying the message to those who still suffer and letting people know that there is recovery available. How am I on time? Am I doing okay?
Oh, another 5 minutes.
Right, that's what I wanted. Perfect. Okay. So in my sobriety in 2012, just the day after Thanksgiving, my husband and I found our daughter's body in her apartment. And I'm pretty sure my husband's heart broke in that moment. I think it broke his heart. It certainly changed my view of my world. And I will tell you, I had no desire to drink, not one. To never go out in the world again, yes. But the people of AA surrounded me and came into this mentally ill girl's home. And those of you who are familiar with mental illness know that house cleaning and maintenance and things like that, they are not real important to seriously mentally ill people. And they cleaned that apartment so that it could be re-rented, and they ushered at her memorial. And then in 2018, my husband died of congestive heart failure. And again, you know, because I had put myself into the middle of AA and I'm going to meetings, I'm being of service, I'm doing the work I need to do, the people of AA surrounded me and loved me. In the last year, my mother died, my father died, a dear friend died, and a sponsee drank herself to death. And I have never once felt deserted by God. I have never once felt deserted by AA. I have felt the profound pain of being a human being and that damn attachment to people. because if they didn't attach, it wouldn't matter, right? But that's not true. I mean, it's not. So the God of my understanding is ever present with, you know, whatever that figurative hand is held out to me to give me comfort at any given time. And I am so grateful to not want to drink today, but I can tell you that nothing would have stopped my drinking. There is nothing, nothing did stop my drinking for a very, very long time. And I have to want to not drink today and to do whatever work I need to do to not drink. So thank you for inviting me to your meeting. I really appreciate it.